Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to Renee's Heart to Heart. I'm glad you joined us. I am in the hopes that most of us have regained some semblance of order in our homes and in our lives. Of course, the most horrific landing for Dorian was the Bahamas. I want to bring Shelley in right away, and I'd like to talk a little bit about catastrophes. They never affect just one thing or one person or one group. A true catastrophe has, tentacles that reach further than the most gigantic kraken or octopus or whatever you want to think of. And that's, of course, what has happened with the Bahamas. Hi, Shell. How are you?
I'm doing good, Rainey. I hope you're doing good, too.
We are. We are fine, and things are getting back to normal. It has not been, for not having a hurricane here, I want to tell you that it was the worst, almost, catastrophe that I have ever gone through. Mostly because it was just so, to be given news with no answers has got to be the worst in the world. To be given facts to be given information without fact I was as close to being clinically depressed as I can remember being in quite some time. I'd wake up in the morning for those 5 days, and it was like, it's not over yet. So everybody lived in like some kind of a, like a space of, you know, being prepared and not needing to be prepared. It was horrendous, I thought. And we didn't even get hurt. And then when we started seeing all the pictures of the Bahamas, and I don't think I've ever told you about a young man that lived with us when he was like, I'm going to say he lived with us from 15 to 18. He was having trouble with his stepdad, and he was a friend of David's. And his mom came to me, and he was there all the time at the house anyway. And she said, can he stay with you? And I said, of course. So he stayed with us for all those years. And, of course, he got really close to the whole family. And he got in some trouble in later years, and he had been born in the Bahamas. So he was sent back to the Bahamas, and that's where he's been for the last probably 30 years. Because he's like 48 years old, you know. And so we heard from him. And I reached out and said, are you okay? And he sent us pictures. He told us stories that you're not seeing on the news. He said, the first time I heard his voice, he could barely talk. He was so emotional. He and his son and his wife are okay. But, you know, they're agile and young. And, of course, the ones that I think, you know, are the weakest on that, on that group of people, of course, are the elderly, the ill. Some of them never had a chance, but he told us stories of even seeing the houses float right out into the ocean, Shelley, and sharks chewing on people. And I can't, you know, he said, I'm hoping this will open the door for me to come home because we have nothing now. We have a boat. And that's what they're staying on, and that's how they're getting around is in this boat because there's water everywhere.
Right.
So,
well, on the news, they're showing all these evacuations, thousands of people are being airlifted out and taken by boat. Some are being taken over to Nassau, to the Nassau Islands. Some of them are being brought over to Florida. So there is a mass exodus because there's no buildings. The pictures they're showing of the Bahamas is there's no place to live. There's no structures in many areas.
Right.
Like on Abaco, when I was watching the Weather Channel today and they're showing pictures of Abacoa, it's just flattened. It looks like a junkyard. It's just all these flattened buildings. There's over, according to the news, and you know, so it's probably a lot more. They're saying there's been 45 confirmed deaths just on the island of Abacoa itself, and over 100 people still missing, unaccounted for. So and then that's not even going to Marsh Harbor yet, you know. So it was a devastating blow. Bahamas used to be, you know, a tourist attraction. It used to be a state-of-the-art island. You know, a lot of the people that lived there struggled. You know, so you have that inequality where, you know, you have people of means going into the resorts, and then the people giving them this wonderful experience are struggling day to day just to be able to survive in these, and some of them in homes that aren't, we wouldn't even consider a real home, you know. So it's the same.
Well, you know, we've been homeless. I've talked about this before on the show, and of course Shelley knows about this. In 1980, right after the, I just lost Shelley. Hopefully she'll call right back in. our house burnt to the ground. Our furnace exploded and burnt to the ground. And it was hard to recoup after that. And, of course, just tonight, Shelley, are you back?
Yeah, I don't know what happened. My phone just dropped the call.
Yeah. Yeah, I was afraid this was still going to happen because the technology is still a little bit screwy here. But I think that the word getting back to some kind of normalcy, I mean, even after the death of a family member, even after, you know, the things that can happen to us that are not pleasant, losing your home, foreclosed on your home, losing your job that you think is wonderful. All these things test our ability to make it through all the different challenges that we come into in our life. But this was like, well, I mentioned the crack in a few minutes ago. Of course, I've watched most of the Pirates of the Caribbean, and that's what I was put in mind of. I mean, where do you hide? Where do you run to?
Yeah.
Who do you ask to protect you? Who do you stand behind? Say you're 10 years old, Shell, and you see these way up your house. Who do you are trying to survive?
You're cutting in and out. I'm missing it.
Is there any? Yeah, I'm afraid it's going to be a difficult night. Yeah, and I dropped you again too. Are you still there?
Yeah. Can you hear me?
I can hear you now. Yeah, but I dropped you for a minute, and it came up on my dashboard that I dropped the call again. But you're still on my dashboard.
Now, now you're clear also, though. You were breaking up a minute ago, so now I can hear you. So, but the whole thing is that, you know, there are so many shifts going on the planet right now. The planet itself is going through so many changes, a lot of them brought about by human beings, to be honest with you, because we've messed with the planet for so much, over-drilling, you know, messing with the ecosystems, taking down the rainforest, you know. So a lot of the tragedy we're seeing is because we have messed with the natural ecosystem so much, you know, and a lot of the environmentalists, the EPA, which is, you know, being gutted to many to some extent, has been warning about this for years, that you can't just you can't just indiscriminately take down thousands of acres of rainforest and not have it impact weather on the other side of the planet. Our planet is very connected from one side to the other. And what happens, you know, like the whole butterfly effect thing, what happens on one side of the planet affects what happens on another. You can't pollute the planet. You know, you can't keep doing these things and not have natural disasters like this all over the place. So if for nothing else, this should, with all, you know, with all of our technology and everything, this should reestablish a respect for nature and a respect for taking care of this world that we were given, and not just indiscriminately drill and mine and blow up and burn and cut down trees and just mess with the natural environment. There's a way of building housing for populations. And every time I see a new development go up, and I think you've mentioned things along this line before, but every time I see a new development going up, oh my God, why don't you take the thousands of houses that are empty and fix them? Instead of building another new development, why don't you take all the houses that are taking up properties, okay, that are sitting vacant, that are creating pestilence holes, because now they're going to sit and they're going to rot where they are, and they're going to bring rodents and bugs and things like that. So, you know, why don't these developers go in and get these homes and turn them out instead of tearing up forestry land and putting up all these apartment buildings? You know, fix what's already there. And we're still pretty much a throwaway society. Instead of repurposing something, instead of reusing something, you know, we throw it away and we get another one. We throw it away and we get another one. And we're being buried in our own garbage in a lot of ways. And that's impacting the integrity of the planet itself. You know, if human beings disappeared from the face of this planet tomorrow, it would repair and be thriving inside a decade.
Well, that's a big conversation, and you and I are both on the same page with that. I've never understood why we don't keep things valuable, such as properties, such as land, such as farm country. I mean, haven't we learned way before your time and my time that we need farms? We need gardens. We need the flowers. We need the bees. I'll be 71 years old this month. I have seen fields that were so untouched that they were like mesmerizing to look at. The only thing that was on them was cows. And they were everywhere. Up north where I'm from, I mean, you could drive for miles. Now, I was at a meeting recently here at Loxahatchee Groves, which is country for South Florida, and some of the people who are equestrians, which means, you know, they spend a lot of money on their horses and a lot of money on showing their horses, and some of them, you know, their family members, their horses are their family members, but some of them do it as a business. So the first thing that's brought up at a meeting is we have to get rid of all the nurseries because, you know, they're bringing in all these big trucks and they're doing this and they're doing that. And I'm like, oh my God, why would that be the first thing you said? The nurseries, where we get the plants and the food? And what are your horses going to eat, kids?
Really. Yep.
So, but they don't look any further than the end of their nose, Shell. They know what's going to make them comfortable. And this is one of the saddest things that I see in the world today. I just had this conversation with somebody the other day, and they said, you know, it's hard anymore to find people who care about anybody. And I said, I know. I said, I've actually removed a few people from my life. for that reason. Not family, yeah. Because I'm a die-hard family person, but people that have been my friends, and a few of them, it's probably about 10 in the last 5 years, that I've just, you know, kind of taken out of my life. Why? Because everything is about them.
Right.
There is, and I'm not looking for them to think about me. In some cases, I'm looking at them to think about themselves, but with the repercussions of not thinking about others as well as themselves. And for some people, they can't wrap their brains around that.
One of the speakers that I was listening to the other day made an interesting comment that that people that take themselves too seriously and blow out of proportion their life experiences generally don't take what happens to other people seriously at all and minimize mm-hmm. what happens to everybody else. And that's exactly what you see.
Mm-hmm.
So everything those types of individuals go through is exaggerated in their minds, and for some reason they lack empathy. They can't say this is happening to me and what's happening to that person over there is so much worse, and help them to feel better about their situation in relation, because in doing that, they give up their badge of honor, their right to getting attention or having people feel sorry for them or something. So they always have to mm-hmm. blow out of proportion what they, you know, what happened to them. The problem with that is that, especially if the person isn't self-aware that they're doing that, is that their life never brings them true happiness. They're always miserable. They're always happy. They're always finding fault in others because at their core, they're really unhappy with themselves. And when you see, mm-hmm. When you see like what happened in the Bahamas, you have both sides of people emerging. You have people that have such strength of character, that literally come out of the woodwork and are inspired to do whatever they can. Some of them are wealthy people. There's that famous chef that went over there, and he's already donated over 20,000 meals. And he's actually there in the Bahamas. I mean, he flew there with his crew, and they're cooking meals and everything. To a young boy who lives up here in Orlando, who was in the news, he had been saving up to go to Disney for a very long time, and he was so heartbroken over what happened in the Bahamas that he took his money and donated it to the Bahama Relief, I think to the Red Cross or something. I don't remember where they said he donated his money, but all the money he had saved, and he was almost there. He almost had enough to get the ticket. He went ahead and he donated it to the Bahamas, and somebody found out about it in Disney. And because he was saving up to do this for his birthday, and Disney was so impressed by his act of just sheer selflessness that they're gifting him and his family a weekend stay at one of their resorts and park tickets. So mm-hmm. it was a very heartwarming mm-hmm. story, you know. But you know, you have children. I mean, this guy was little. You know, I don't think he was maybe 12 or 13 years old. I mean, he was a young man, and he was mm-hmm. so moved by what mm-hmm. happened in the Bahamas. How many adults are like, you know, like not even praying for these people? You know, they don't seem to even be aware that there are tens of thousands, actually hundreds of thousands of people right now that are basically homeless, you know, and so much loss of life. And like you said, I find that very disturbing, the story that your friend shared with you of how some of the people lost their lives. I think that's just heart-wrenching.
Mm-hmm.
Horrible mm-hmm. to know. You know, I remember the first couple of days, one of the first death reports, when they had said there were only, at that point, when there were only 7 confirmed deaths, 5 on the island
yes.
and 1 here in Florida.
Yes.
And one of them was a 7-year-old mm-hmm. boy, and that just broke my heart. That was one
right.
of the first death reports, and then his sister hadn't been found yet. So I don't know what happened with that particular boy, if the sister was ever found, but my thoughts are probably that she wasn't. But that was just devastating mm-hmm. to me. You know, it's one thing you know, for an older sick person to die or something like that, or somebody to get hit in the head with a tube. But a child, that's just heart-wrenching to me.
Yeah. There truly isn't, well, to most of us, not to everybody, but to most of us, that's the epitome of tragedy, to lose a child. And I think that most of us, when we watch something like what happened in the Bahamas, it's so overwhelming. I think a lot of people can't even really wrap their brains around it, Shelley. They can't even fathom the enormity of that tragedy. I'm put in mind of a guest that we had years ago at Hippocrates, and I just thought of this. But she, Enid, came in all upset because one of the ladies in the Casa Grande house kept rearranging all the furniture in the living room. And Enid kept going in with the other girls at the end of the day and fixing the furniture again. And she comes to me, Enid comes to me, and she says, "Miss Rini, you have to do something about this lady. You know, this is ridiculous. Every day she put," I said, "What are you doing with the furniture?" And she says, "She's putting it all in a circle." And she said, "You can't even walk through to get to the other door, right?" So I said, "Who is this?" And she told me. And I said, "Sit down." She sat down and she says, "Oh, now you're going to tell me some reason why this is okay." And I said, "Well, I'm going to tell you what happened to this lady that you have to keep to yourself." And she said, "Okay." I said, "She just survived a tsunami. And a tsunami is devastating. And seldom has any survivors. So for some reason, she thinks she's got to gather everybody, keep them." I mean, this is just my analogy, by the way, you know, but it just made so much sense to me. And when she told me that it was in a circle, I was like, yeah.
Right.
I said, she's just trying to keep everybody safe. So then once I explained it to Enid, she was like, "Oh my God, I didn't even know what a tsunami was, Miss Rini." And of course, she grew up in Jamaica. I don't know how she couldn't know about a tsunami. But
remember, tsunamis aren't common.
No, I know. I know, but even still, it would seem like if you lived your life on a beachfront island, you would still be a little bit familiar with something like a tsunami. But at any rate, this was, and I even went to Brian and Anna so that I could get extra help for her from Andy and Anthony, because she hadn't told anybody that this, you know, it was a fear. She was so afraid that it was going to happen here in Florida. You know, and I said,
goodness.
To my knowledge, it never has, you know, but I understand why, you know, why you're worried about it. Of course you're worried about it. But those kind of survival, there's a question for you, Shell. What is easier when you see what all those people in the Bahamas just saw? Passing over to what you believe in? Or being here and having to live with that vision for the rest of your life? Which sounds easier to you, honey?
Say the question again.
Which sounds easier to you? Being caught up in that catastrophe and moving on to whatever you believe is next, or surviving and having to remember what you saw for the rest of your life?
Well, because I believe in life after death, I don't think it's a matter of easier. I think that anybody that transitions, that it was their time that they chose to go. I certainly think that staying behind with the challenges of being a survivor can go in multiple directions based on the resilience of the person, their spiritual belief system, at exactly what they experienced. I mean, not everybody experienced the violence and the deaths right in front of their eyes. A lot of people did, some did not. So I think what's going to happen is it's the severity of what they went through. I think everybody's going to be suffering some sort of PTSD because it was literally like being in a war zone. because the winds did mm-hmm. not let up for 48 hours. You know, I've been in hurricanes that lasted for 5 or 6 hours, and then you go through the eye, and then bam, and then the other side hits you, and you got another 5 or 6 hours on the other side. I can't even imagine sitting in 185 going down to 140 mile an hour winds for 48 hours. I just can't even imagine that. I mean, because it's like relentless fear. Your hormones are just putting out these what are called fear hormones in your body. I can't see how these people are going to be able to sleep well or anything. So the physiological and the mental impact of surviving something like that is like being in a war zone. So I'm struggling with the question because I don't think one is easier than the other. I think they're two very different experiences, but I definitely think
if I used the word easier, I didn't mean to use the word easier. I said, which would you rather be? The person that moves on, because if you just said, you know, I believe in, you know, moving on to something beautiful. And I mean, we've had these discussions 100 times on the show. I don't want to discuss that tonight, or being left here and having to deal with the trauma and the survival of everything you did see. For me, it would have been, I would have rather gone with my other loved ones more than likely than stay behind, unless, because I'm who I am, unless I thought there was somebody here that was going to need me so I couldn't leave. So,
right.
But the lifelong trauma.
Right. If you're talking about somebody who lost their entire family.
That's what most of them did. Yes.
Right. I mean, that's one thing. But because, like you said, because of who we are, and if there was a thought that you would be some assistance to the other survivors, my draw, if I survived, would be to then hook up with other survivors in a way of creating a support system, finding other people that survived, mm-hmm. and being of assistance to help those people to move on. And I mean, you survive for a reason. So, and that's how I would look at it. If I survived and there was a reason I survived, and now I have to do something with the fact that I'm still here, and what can I do to make the most positive impact? And you do see a lot mm-hmm. of those type of people rising from the rubble, so to speak, and stepping
yep.
up. You know, some people are still in shock. In fact, I think probably most of the people are still in shock. Most of the people are, that's what I'm saying, so they're being cared for and taken away. But you do have some of the Bahamians that are actually stepping up, trying to be of assistance to the other people. And a lot of them did lose everything. You know, one of the
yeah.
things that
well,
they're not
I want to say
about,
most.
Yeah.
Most of them lost everything. I mean, it was pretty much leveled. From everything
yep.
that I've been given to understand. So
mm-hmm.
as far as, you know, the survival, it's, you know, it's one of like it must be like a war zone or worse than a war zone because the water's mm-hmm. still sitting. So you can just about imagine
well,
between the life from the ocean, the heat. I mean, it's also horrendously hot. I woke up this morning thinking to myself, you know, I wonder if it's going to be rainy today or if it's going to be so sweltering because it's been like 97, 98 degrees. I was instantly ashamed of myself. Instantly. Oh, poor Rini.
Wow.
I'm going, oh, poor Rini. You know, I'm thinking to myself, what a bitch you are.
Well, the whole thing is that the bottom line is, you know, whether what we're going through here is as severe as what the four people in Bahamas just went through or not is irrelevant. The bottom line is you still have to be concerned about excess heat. You still have to be concerned because, you know, people can have heat strokes and heart attacks and things like that just from being exposed to the heat. So just because somebody else is in a more dire situation than you doesn't mean you have to then all of a sudden act like your situation, you know, isn't a challenge. So
isn't
you know,
important.
So you can't
sure.
put one extreme to the other. But
well,
people like you and I,
yeah.
Yeah, for people like you and I that are very, very sensitive and very caring about other people, we do tend to minimize what we're going through in light of something that's more catastrophic. But the bottom line is we still have to be sensitive to, you know, to what we're going through. One of the things that I found shocking, and this happened within the first couple of days, this is while the Bahamas were still being pummeled. So that's how long ago this was. Some of the images that were coming over on the Weather Channel that I found shocking were these people that had gone into the attic of their house. So it was a two-story house. They're in the attic of their house. So they can't go any higher up than this, and there was water coming up the stairs into the attic. I mean, just think about it. I mean, like, where are they going to go? They had no place else to go.
Yeah.
Another guy was on the second floor of his house, and he was like one of the politicians. He was one of the he was part of the government of Bahama, and he's there with his cell phone, and he's taking all these pictures. They're in the second story of his house, and it was a huge top floor of this house. And he had these huge plate glass windows. I guess they're hurricane-proof windows because he didn't have them boarded up and you could actually see through them.
Right.
And the waves were halfway up the glass doors. And he's like, oh, my God. And you hear him as he's filming this on his phone. He's saying, oh, my God, I hope the glass holds, you know, because he's thinking of hurricane winds. He's not thinking of water, you know. The water was halfway up the doors. You know, if those doors burst, the ocean was going to come into his house, and he had no higher to go. That was it. You know, so it's like the images that people were getting on their cell phones and sending to people were terrifying. And I wasn't even there.
I know.
And I felt that in the pit of my stomach, and I felt that angst. You know.
Me too. Me too. Well, there was one that some young people. They had a rope, and they were all tied to each other around their waist, going through the rushing water. And they had an elderly lady with them. When I say elderly, I don't know, anywhere between 50 and 80, who knows, you know. But you could tell she was the oldest of all of them. And they put her in the middle so that somebody was behind her and somebody was in front of her, and there were like five of them. And somebody's taping them, saying swim, swim. And of course, if they'd have taken their feet off the ground because they were touching, that would have been their demise because they'd have been swept away. So
right.
I'm watching it thinking to myself, no, don't swim, keep walking, you
right.
know. But
right.
It was awful, Shelley. It was just, and I thought to myself, you know, but some of them did survive. It's like when we heard from Kevin, we were all so excited to hear from him and know that he and his little boy are okay. I mean, they're okay in the sense of being alive and not hurt anywhere. But he said, even when he talks on the, because he talks to me on Messenger, you know, and he can't even not talk without any kind of emotional reaction. It was just that awful.
Wow.
So, but that's why when I thought about this show tonight, and I've been reading all these different stories of survival, which is awesome. I mean, you know, that in and of itself is pretty cool that some people did survive. But it makes me wonder why we live places like that, first of all. And I mean, you know, if you live there all your life and you become accustomed to it, it's like some of the people that I know that live in Hawaii. And they have, and us, we live here in Florida, and we have hurricanes, you know.
Right.
So I don't know.
If you think about the how long the Bahamas have been there, how long it's been a tourist trade. Same thing with Hawaii. I mean, it's rare that. Well, first of all, they said that this particular hurricane set all new records. It was up there.
Yeah,
it was
that's
tied
true.
With three other hurricanes. The problem with this hurricane is that it stalled as a Category 5, and it's the first hurricane that's ever done that in recorded history. They don't ever have that happening before. And so this was absolutely more devastating, even more devastating than Andrew. And that's probably the most devastating one that ever hit Florida. But they said that it was because it stalled at 185 mile. So it was doing 185 mile an hour winds for 24 hours. Then it dropped to 140, but then it still sat there for another 24 hours. So it's devastating. You know, if something goes through at 185 miles an hour, but it goes across the island in like half a day or even 24 hours, it would have done less damage. It was because it sat there for that extra 24 hours because
it just sat there and kept beating them up. Yep.
Right, right. And so buildings, finally the structures just finally gave way, splintered apart, you know. So, this was really unprecedented in history that we had that type of a hurricane happen.
Of course, you know, I said to the kids, I remember several years ago, I answered something. It was about come and see, I don't know, one of those timeshare or something it was. And we got to go and have a place in Daytona Beach. So I said to Spike, I said, let's just take A1A all the way. And he goes, oh, only you would want to do that. And I said, why? I said, it'd be a nice, slow, easy drive, no pressure. I don't have to drive like Mario Andretti. And, you know, we'll just check out the beach, right? I was shocked to see, Shell, that from like Jupiter, as you get north of Jupiter, almost every house that's on the beach is on stilts, like they are in Key West. Did you know that?
Yeah. Yeah,
I didn't realize that. I mean, I've seen them in the Keys because after Andrew, a lot of them rebuilt. Because first time I went to the Keys when I was a kid, the Keys was so laid back. I mean, you know, you'd see movies of Key West and it was like, I don't know, a whole other, it was true hippiedom, you know. and there were, you know, there were just fishing places. There were, you know, it was really, really, really laid back. And then when we went again, when we came to Florida this past time, me and Spike and all the kids, he and I went down there in about, I don't know, 1996 or 97. And it was totally changed because after Andrew, they didn't let any houseboats out on the shallow part of the ocean, right near the southernmost tip. That used to be filled with houseboats where people lived there.
Yeah.
And it just totally changed. It like wiped it out. And of course, I've had many interesting conversations with our friend Rita Romano, who lived there for a long time. And she told me of all the different things that they had to change. So they kind of, I don't know, they didn't really protect themselves because the Keys still get a hell of a hurricane.
Didn't she like lose her car in the Keys? It got like covered with water or something?
Yeah, during one of the smaller hurricanes before she moved up here.
During one of the hurricanes, yeah, because she evacuated, but her car was left there for some reason. I guess she evacuated with other people, and when she went back, her car was basically underwater. And I remember that.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. So, but I mean, you know, this scenario, this Bahama thing, I mean, and right here, right now, Big Dog Ranch, for those of you who don't know, this lady is a very special lady. I hear only wonderful, wonderful good things about her. And she just got something like 50 or 60 dogs today. That will be in quarantine for a little while, and then they'll be available for adoption. And they showed pictures of them tonight on television. And, from the Bahamas.
Oh, wow. It's so interesting that you brought that up because that was one of the things I was saying. I haven't heard anything about animal rescues yet.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. They've been bringing dogs in to Miami. And like, you know, kind of like filtering them out all the way up through. And I believe the count was 60 today, landed here right down the street from me at the Big Dog Rescue. And I was by there this morning, and there were trucks and all kinds of flags and everything up, you know, because, you know, in a way of, I don't know, making the people that did the drudgery of going to get them and getting them here safely, you know, to celebrate them doing that job. So, and there's been some other farm animals as well, but I don't know where they are. I want to say someplace in Miami, but there's a lot of people doing a lot of wonderful things, a lot of people raising money, a lot of people, you know, sending, like we did for Miami during Andrew. You know, I mean, we are a wonderful people. When tragedy strikes, it's always been sad for me that we're not like that all the time.
Well, one of the things that impressed me on the news tonight, one of the things that impressed me on the news tonight is that, and you may have been seeing this for the last couple of days. I had actually stopped watching the coverage a couple of days ago, so I just started watching it again tonight. That a lot of people in the Florida area that have private airplanes. I mean, they're private citizens. They're not part of the government. They're not part of the Red Cross. They're private citizens are donating to bring supplies. They're taking their airplanes to bring supplies into Nassau and the Bahamas. And this organization that is asking for private pilots is paying for their gas. So, I mean, they have to do the flying. So, you know, but the bottom line is that's incredible. You know, that they would volunteer their time in that way.
I thought it was wonderful too, yes. And even people with big yachts are going in loaded with, you know, like the obvious things like water and food, but also with clothing, diapers, formula, medicine, things like that. Some of the bigger cruise lines are doing that as well. So, you know, I mean, there's no doubt about the fact that when we are hurt, I mean, we've got a little personal thing going on here at home, and I think that's why I wanted to talk about this tonight, because the 12th of October will be the 10-year anniversary of Michael being set on fire. The 11th of October is his 25th birthday. So, and the 8th of October is his dad, my second son, Michael, his 50th birthday. So I'm planning a big party. And there was a couple family members, very close family members, that felt like they couldn't celebrate that day. And I mean, it kind of turned into you know, kind of a drama. And so I went to my grandson and I said, you live through this. If you don't want to celebrate your survival on the 12th, you just tell me and we won't talk about it ever again. And he goes, why wouldn't I want to celebrate that, Graham? I'm finally doing okay. And I said, I know. I mean, you know, for the first time ever, he's pretty happy. He sits and holds, who I am babysitting right now, by the way, while I'm doing the show, this little princess who's sitting on my lap staring at my computer and anything else she can look at. Yeah. And I mean, he brings her out, sits with her on his lap, changes her diapers, helps with her baths, feeds her, everything, grinning from ear to ear. He has a decent job and works every day. And when it was said, you know, I can't get rid of the things that I remember about that day. And I'm like, you think everybody can't remember those things that day? Everybody in this family, I mean, the ones of us that were there every day, we all remember it. But it's really not about us. It's not about us. It's about his survival. We were going to survive no matter what. None of us were hurt, you know. And I'm thinking about those people over there, and that's why I brought up, you know, which sounds like it would be the most livable condition to have left with everybody that you loved, or to be here to carry on? And I guess we kind of answered that by saying it all depends on what kind of person you are, right? All
right.
Depends on whether or not you are a – most survivors I've found are leaders in one way or another. They don't always know it in the very beginning, but I think eventually they find out that they're a leader. And it doesn't seem to matter what they lead, whether they're the leader at their job or the leader in their football game or the leader in their family or whatever they are. Survivors very often are bona fide leaders. And and that's one of the reasons they survive, you know, because they have it in them to survive. And I think that's who Michael is.
They almost have a calling to take what happened to them and use their experience, use their whatever tragedy befell them to help other people either sidestep that particular type of experience or to see that you could go through something like that and still have a life worth living. So their impetus is either one or the other. And those are the people that actually do have happy lives. You know, I mean, we have women that are raped that become reclusive and never come out of their homes anymore and then just live, you know, just horribly empty, shallow lives, tormented every day by what happened to them. And then you have other women that actually choose to forgive their perpetrator. And again, when we talk about forgiveness, we're not saying the guy didn't do anything wrong. We're just saying disconnecting from the violence of that whole thing and any thoughts of revenge, you know, and open themselves up to love. And, you know, 5 years later, they're married and they have a child, you know, and their
That's
whole
right.
life is okay. So it doesn't mean that they don't ever from time to time remember what happened and still have pangs of fear or, you know, it doesn't mean any of that. What it means is that they're resilient enough to like, okay, this guy didn't take my life, so I'm going to make something out of it. And a lot of the survivors that I hear on the stories that I follow, that's why they survived. They say, you know, this person that killed my loved one didn't kill me. I'm not going to let them take anybody else from my family, including me. I'm going to live to honor that person. Otherwise, they died in vain. But if I keep their memory alive and if I live to honor them, then he hasn't won or something like that. You know, and I hear these type of comments, and they're very impactful on me when you hear the type of things that, like you said, a survivor has to say, or somebody that embraces life to the point that, yeah, tragedy happens all around us. It's what you do with that tragedy, you know, how you rise above it that makes your life worth living or not.
Amen. Amen. Everything at the end of the day is what we make of it, isn't it, Shell? You can look at something. You know, the glass half empty, the glass half full, all of those kind of old adages are everything. They're everything.
Right.
You are out of a messy relationship, so you wallow in self-pity, or you're like, okay, stand up, dust yourself off, start your next adventure, your next journey. Everybody has different ways of dealing with everything. But I don't want to compare some of the things that I have lived through with the devastation of what happened in the Bahamas by any stretch of the imagination. But I do want to say to anybody who has good energy level, who knows how to ground themselves, and knows how to put out peaceful energy into the air, because now the drama, the trauma, and more disasters will start brewing because people will get angry, people are tired, people are devastated. You know, now is the time when, if you can, send out the kind of I mean, there's nobody to forgive because it was an act of Mother Nature. But the things that may, you know, the ramifications from this may be due to another person. So I think if we could just send out literally, it kind of sounds like a pun, but calming waters to that area, and the people who need to leave because they simply can't start all over again, and the people who can start all over again, give them the kind of strength and the stamina, and hopefully from some of us, the wherewithal to rebuild and to start their lives over again. If that's their where their family has lived for generations and they don't want to leave, I get it. I think we all get it. But I think that being aware. Go ahead, honey.
Well, I mean, I love what you just said, and to kind of take the next step from that is that understanding that we really are all one, we're all connected on some level, you know, regardless of what you know, religious aspirations you have, the bottom line is a lot of people today are understanding that we are really connected. And so when one part of our societies are suffering, it sends waves throughout the world. So a lot of people that are feeling displaced right now, that are, because I've noticed it the last few days myself, by the way, I've just woken up and sometimes I feel lost. I'm in my own house. Nothing's going wrong. I've actually had a very successful couple of days on a project I'm working on. And yet there, I get these waves throughout the day of actually feeling disoriented and feeling like I should be doing something else that like, you know, and I finally, it dawned on me tonight when I was watching the news that I'm picking up all these individuals that are displaced in the Bahamas because that energy permeates, you know, global consciousness, you know. So when you're talking about mass consciousness, we happen to these suffering of other people, okay? And if you're not self-aware enough to analyze, you know, nothing's going wrong with me. I, you know, like I said, I'm moving along with the things I'm supposed to be doing. So where would this disorientation come from? And that's it. And I'm tapping into all these emotions coming from the Bahamas. So if you can help by volunteering, volunteer. If you can send money, send money. If you can physically go there, go there. In other words, get involved, do whatever you can do. And if you can't do any of that, prayers are hugely, hugely beneficial. When you have thousands or tens of thousands of people saying a prayer, saying the same prayer, or saying prayers with the same intention, it is hugely powerful to shift mass consciousness and have a calming effect. I had mentioned to you that I wanted to say a short prayer tonight. Now, this is kind of a Unitarian prayer, so it can be modified to any religion if you have a particular way of praying, but I'm going to go ahead and say the prayer, and then if the wording is not exactly how you would say it, modify it. Say it whatever way would make sense to you, but this is just an example of one way of praying for catastrophes or mass suffering or something like that. Is that okay with you?
Okay. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Okay, so in order to pray for other people, you have to first call on what's called our I Am Presence. You can call it the soul, the higher conscious, but for the sake of this prayer, it's called the I Am Presence, okay? So the way the prayer says is that, okay, so this is the prayer. I am my I Am Presence, and I am one with the I Am Presence of all humanity. I am a peace-commanding presence, and I call upon the entire company of heaven and the I Am presence of every person involved in any negative event or atrocity, any violence, fear, tragedy, or trauma, to envelop him or her in an invincible force field of God's infinite protection and divine comfort. And then you would just repeat that three times. And at the end, you would just end by saying thank you, and so it is. And it's a very simple prayer, very short, you know, but you're just praying for protection and comfort to come to people that are involved in some sort of a tragedy or catastrophe.
Well, and the days to come, let's also mention the fact that sometimes the hardest part of the journey is the recovery time. When you're in the throes of a catastrophe, like they just were, something kicks in and you just are like at your pit bull stage. You know, you're like, okay,
like
let's do this. And then all of a sudden, yes, exactly. And then all of a sudden, you know, you realize, well, I think that's what happened to me this week. I just all of a sudden, I hadn't even been watching the Bahamian thing. Because I thought to myself, what can I do, you know, except for feel sad and be worried about everybody. And I concentrated on what was going on here. And then I realized I was feeling overwhelmed about what was going on here. One day we were okay. And the next day, you know, be careful because this is this. We ran around, we got everything. And then I hear people fighting about a lady who takes, you know, 15 cases of water instead of making sure that everybody's got enough to go around. And I'm hearing all this kind of talk and everything. And I actually felt sick, Shell, to my stomach.
Right.
I woke up and
right.
I said to Spike, I said, I feel like, I'm going to cry. You know,
right.
I mean, I just felt like I was going to cry. So I want to say that to those people that are over there now, and now that the actual attack, so to speak, has subsided, and now you're in recovery, stay strong, but also stay serene. Put yourself in a place where you know that you can do everything you need to do. Don't put demands on yourself when you can't do something. Remember to care and to love yourself as well as the person standing next to you. You have to, because if you don't have those feelings of serenity and love, this will be the hardest time of your life, this recovery from something so tragic. And, I, you know, I can't say that enough, because I was remembered today when I was trying to calm a family member about this thing for Mike, the day that we came home early in the morning after sitting up all night and finally getting to see Mikey. And I brought my son home and left my daughter-in-law at Jackson Memorial. And we got to my house and I wanted to go to work and I wanted my son to lay down. And he stood up and grabbed a hold of me and said, Mom, if Mike dies, you have to shoot me.
Aww.
And I said, Michael, that's not going to happen. Besides that, your father would never let me have a gun, and we tried to make light of it, right? But I've never forgot
Aww.
Him looking at me, you know, with
yep.
tears in his eyes and saying that to me.
Yep.
And
yep.
you remember all of those kind of things, and things like that,
yep.
believe it or not, even though they are sad, they also
mm-hmm.
make you stronger. Because
mm-hmm.
none of us
well,
want to be quitters.
Well,
we really
well,
don't.
Well, I think that Right. Well, everything that Mike went through is certainly something to celebrate. And I think sometimes
yeah.
people have, you know, sometimes people are intimidated by the survival of other people, because if they see weaknesses mm-hmm. in themselves, it almost makes them feel fragile in comparison. And they it's almost like, this is probably a very bad analogy, and I know we're almost out of time, but it's almost like somebody wins the lottery and somebody hears about it, and instead of being happy for them, they go into like, oh, well, why did it happen for them? Nothing good ever happens for me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sometimes
yeah.
people are intimidated by survivors. It's almost like they're put off by them, because on some level it makes them feel that they couldn't have risen to
got
the occasion
cheated.
And make something out of their
cheated.
Life.
Yeah.
So sometimes
yeah, you're right.
Sometimes
you're right.
Very...
And I've seen that many, many times. Mm-hmm.
But Michael definitely has a lot to celebrate. Very proud of him. And I hope that everything with his birthday party goes off really beautifully.
I do too, honey. I do too. And if I have anything to say about it, indeed it will. So we have that going for us too, because you know what a bitch I can be. So, so let's just keep that positivity flowing in that direction, south, and make sure that somehow that like breeze of love and support and camaraderie wraps its arms around all the people that feel like they're all by themselves. And
yes,
feeling like they're not all by themselves will give them the strength they need to make it through the next probably couple of years. So God bless all of them. Thanks, honey bunch.
Yes.
We'll be back on Wednesday. And not sure what we're going to talk about. I did talk to Monica, and you know her, she just wants to talk about the gut and the this and that. So we'll figure out something. So we'll be back on Wednesday night, and everybody enjoy their next couple days. God bless. Thanks, Shell. Talk to you soon, baby.
All right, Sheep. I love you, and God bless everyone.
Bye-bye. Yes, Grandma's little pumpkin face. Grandma's little pumpkin face, aren't you? Huh? You've been such a
doing this show with Graham, haven't you?